All right, so we're here with Rick Rashid, the leader of Microsoft Research. So when did Microsoft Research start? What's your background? What do you do?
Okay, well, I came to Microsoft back in September of 1991. Before that, I was a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh for 12 years.
Nice.
My research area is operating systems. And really, I think that's how I got connected to Microsoft in the first place, because it turns out that some of the early work that led to the project that became Windows NT was actually based on some operating systems work I did at CMU, you know, back in the 1980s. And so there were people at Microsoft that knew about my work, and when they decided they wanted to start a basic research lab, I guess I was high on their list of people to come and talk to.
Excellent.
And so decided to come, and you know, been building it ever since.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit specifically about what was that work that it was based on. I mean, we're talking about the monolithic kernel model. I mean, what?
Well, this was work that I did originally on something that was called the Accent operating system, and then the follow-on to that, which was called the Mach operating system. So that was the work that, for example, Next and eventually Apple built on as a basis for what became the Mac OS. But it was also that same operating system was used by a number of other people. So it was used as part of the Open Software Foundation's OSF1, and it was that then became the basis for Digital Unix. I mean, Digital's Unix product, which then became Compaq or HP True64.
Okay.
And so it's made its way into a number of places around.
That's excellent. Well, that should feel good to have, you know, work you've done all over the place.
Well, it's fun. You know, I think of myself, you know, I've been a professor and an academic, but I've also, over the years, written a lot of software, a lot of code.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably written about 600,000 lines of code in my life, which includes multiple operating systems, several computer games, one of which Microsoft shipped.
Nice.
And then, you know, file systems, networking code, programming languages, stuff like that.
Excellent. Now, of course, you're running MSR, which works in all of those areas.
Right, which is good because it gives me, you know, because I've done work in a number of different research areas over the years, it gives me the opportunity to really understand a lot of what people are doing. And of course, the fact that I've written a lot of code over the years means that if someone tells me something can't be done, I can say, well, gee, I could do that. I don't really have the time to do it, but you know, at least gives me an opportunity to try to encourage them.
Excellent. So, I mean, your title is Senior Vice President.
Right.
Typically, when you think of a vice president, it's executive, it's management, you manage the general managers, etc. But you're actually closely involved with the research, right?
I mean, I do. I wind up doing all of that. You know, my job's pretty diverse. You know, I spend a certain amount of time, you know, working with, over the years, Bill Gates and, you know, Craig Mundy and Ray Ozzie on strategy issues.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I've got a management part of my job and helping to keep Microsoft Research running. Although that's not incredibly difficult. I mean, we've got great people. I've hired really good, you know, managing directors for the various labs. And so, you know, I think they can mostly take care of themselves most of the time. And then I also do get involved in some of the research. And again, that varies depending on what my schedule really looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, I've worked on a variety of projects, including some of our operating systems work.
Excellent. Like Singularity, perhaps?
I was involved in that probably more in the beginning and less now. Working with Galen Hunt and some of the other people on that team and in the very early days.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's really been their work since then.
Excellent. So it brings up a good point. I remember the first blog post I ever wrote, I'm not really a blogger, but I had been encouraged to start blogging by my ex-manager, was the question simply, is operating system research dead? Because it just seemed that we still have these legacy systems that are running basically 70s, 80s era architectures. But then, of course, comes along Singularity. But What are your feelings on that? I mean, like, how do you feel? Let me hear your feelings on the state of the operating system today as a construct, not a product. Just as a construct. How do you feel about the way that software is driving hardware?
Well,
abstracting it.
I think there's been a lot of change. I think sometimes people don't. It's easy to look at things and say, "Gosh, you know, isn't that sort of what it used to be?" Mm. You know, when there in fact has been a lot of evolution and change over a period of time. I think what we're seeing right now is a lot of change, partly in the way people are thinking about building those systems. Mm. You know. People are looking at different kinds of problems to be solved with systems now. They want to build sort of larger, more distributed systems. They want to be able to build systems that span large numbers of sensors in a sensor network. They want to be able to build systems that support these very large data centers. Mm. And each of those are really interesting problems. Each of them requires attacking how you build out the system in a different way. And each one is challenging and interesting. And so I look at this operating systems area as one where it's constantly evolving.
Okay.
You're not... sometimes people say it's not interesting unless you're always starting from a blank sheet of paper every time you're trying to build a system. And I don't think we start from blank sheets of paper very much anymore.
Sure.
Partly because there's very little need to. There's lots of good code out there. There's lots of good ideas and algorithms and things that have been done, and there's no reason not to take advantage of them. Mm. At the same time, we're solving problems, or we're trying to solve problems today that we didn't have 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and that causes us to do new things, whether it's the way we design the data storage systems is changing, the way we think about the structure of the system, what's local, what's remote, how you pull the pieces together is changing. And in some cases, our basic ideas about what is an algorithm, you know, in sort of for an operating system changes. And when you think, for example, about the sensor network problem, you're almost beginning to think about more like, you know, swarming behavior, where it's really the probabilistic characteristics of a computation that's distributed around that's interesting, rather than a deterministic behavior for all the components or all the pieces.
Hmm. Interesting. So, what's the core value, in your opinion, of MSR?
I think the main reason why a company like Microsoft would have a basic research organization is really for agility. It's to allow the company to change rapidly when something happens, whether that's something good or something bad. You know, if you have a new competitor, or if there's a new technology, or the business climate changes, or the economy changes, each of those things puts stress on a company, just like it would put stress on a society. And whenever there's stress, you need to be able to rapidly evolve or rapidly change. One way to do that is to have already, within yourself, the seeds of change. Mm. And I think a basic research organization gives you those seeds of change. Mm. You know, if you have a new competitor, the chances are good, you know, that we will already have research in the area that competitor works in. Mm-hmm. And the chances are we have an IP portfolio and that we've got people that can help lead the company in a new direction.
Sure.
New technology comes up. Well, we probably saw it coming.
Mm-hmm.
We probably already have people working in that space. And now we can help the company adapt. And I think if you look at a lot of the companies in the technology field that were around when Microsoft Research first got started in 1991, not that many of them are still around. And Microsoft is. I think one of the reasons is because we have made investments over a long time. And we've evolved the company as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, virtually every part of Microsoft has been touched by Microsoft Research. And many large chunks of Microsoft came out of Microsoft Research, whether it's the tablet PC efforts, you know, all the 3D activities that led to DirectX and the the Windows 3D technologies, and eventually to Xbox and Xbox 360. Hmm. I started a group back in 1992 that evolved into what became the Digital Media Division, now part of our Entertainment and Devices Division. Spun them out in 96, and they just grew from there.
Excellent.
I started the first e-commerce group in the company. All the work we do in data mining came out of the research group working with SQL to get those technologies into our products. A lot of key changes for Microsoft over the years have come out of the work we've done in basic research.
Excellent. I mean, and it's great that you mentioned that, because there is a perception out there that we don't get the great ideas out of Cambridge, out of Redmond, out of Beijing quick enough into our products. We're like, these are really cool ideas. Why don't you productize them? Sometimes that's how the public feels.
Well, I think that, first off, I think a lot of technologies do make it into our products, in some cases faster than people might otherwise have guessed. I mean, for example, with Windows Vista in the device developer kit, we actually have a proof tool, a software proof tool that can be used by device developers to be able to prove a set of properties about their device drivers. That's kind of unusual. I mean, I don't think very many people would have guessed that we could have moved that technology from what was research back in, the 2001, 2002, 2003 timeframe into a product ship mode really by 2004, 2005, because that's really when a lot of that stuff got locked down for Vista release.
Sure.
So, so that's an example. I mean, there are a number of other examples where we've taken technologies from our research groups and moved it into our products really very rapidly. I think it's always easy to say, I saw this really cool thing and then I never saw a product out as a result. Well, Microsoft product groups, just like any other product organization in any other company, they have their own process. I mean, they have to make decisions. Does it make sense to introduce a particular technology? Does it make sense to do this product? There's a financial part of it. There's a physical human part of it. And each group is going to make their decisions. We do work really closely, though, with our product groups. And I'm actually surprised by how rapidly we do move technology into our products. And it's interesting, when I was elected into the National Academy of Engineering back in 2003, part of the citation for my election was my work in operating systems, but the other part was really innovation in industrial research, which was really focused on the fact that we are able to move our technologies rapidly into our products.
Excellent. So that brings up a good question, in the sense that what's the typical pattern of interaction with a product team? Do they go, well, let's go ask the geniuses whether or not they know how to figure out this big problem that we're running into? Or do you go, hey, we just figured out something really interesting and I think it would work well in that product? What's the synergy between?
Well, to be honest, there's no one way. There's no formula. There's no magic elixir. There's nothing in a bottle you can buy. Technology transfer is really a full contact sport. I mean, almost anything you could imagine will work or fail. You just have to work at it. Technology transfer is more about people than it is about technology. It's about, in some sense, getting ideas from one person's head into another person's head. It's about building trust and relationships. And it's not, there are lots of different ways to do it. I mean, we do pretty much everything. We have a specific team of people whose job it is to do technology transfer. So that's now about a dozen people, program managers. They work with our research teams. They work with the product teams. They keep track of product schedules.
Excellent.
They look at relationships, and they try to make that connection. You can think of them as they do the matchmaking. They arrange the wedding. They cater it. If necessary, they do the daycare center or maybe the marriage counseling. They do everything that's necessary to get a group of people to believe enough in another group of people that they can work well together. And it really goes both ways. We have cases where product groups come to us with problems.
Mm-hmm.
They say, we really have a problem. You need to solve it. Mm-hmm. And we've got smart people, and we can solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I find that fun.
Sure.
People have come to me on several occasions where they just had some terrible problem, and it was holding them up from shipping, and they needed to be able to get it solved. And you could have some very fun work come out of that. And I personally like doing it. But it's just as often the case that researchers will come up with an idea, mm-hmm. or a technology, and then they'll say, well, who can we get to take it? You know, how do we get this out there?
Yeah.
And we don't just work with our product team. So, you know, about 2 years ago, we announced a program for external licensing of technologies. And so increasingly now Microsoft is licensing Microsoft Research Technologies to other companies, in particular to startups. And we've had a number of startups that have been created using technologies that came out of Microsoft Research.
But they're building their own technologies just on a platform that we provided, or some algorithms, for example, or technology.
They could be licensing algorithms, they could be licensing code, they could be, you know, it's like with any other licensing program, there's lots of things that you license. typically, it's a good example is a company that started I think about a year and a half or so ago called Inrix. They do traffic data and traffic analysis. By traffic meaning cars,
okay.
not computer traffic or network traffic. And they use technology that we developed for doing traffic flow analysis within cities. They've adapted it to their environment, and you know, now they're a growing and reasonably successful startup.
Excellent. Cool. Well, I mean, so you don't have a favorite line of research, do you still? I mean, are you still an operating systems that's still in your heart?
Well, I still enjoy my own research area quite a bit.
So you're still doing research actively?
But I try to. I don't always get to do it any given day.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I still try to remain, you know, maintain a certain level of activity. But honestly, you know, we do so many exciting things. I mean, mm-hmm. I really get excited. You know, we've got researchers that are coming up with incredibly new and interesting ways of managing photos and digital information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the technology has shown up now in this thing called PhotoSynth.
Yes.
That's out of Live Labs. But the underlying, you know, algorithms and the mathematics associated with that, just really fascinating. And it's changing the way you think about being able to reconstruct three-dimensional environments just from random pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that has potential impacts on, you know, these large collection of photos people are beginning to accumulate on the web.
Absolutely.
What you might be able to do with them. So I think that's really fun. We've got this really interesting work now that seems to be at the intersection between biology and computer science. I've seen more of my researchers now working with biologists, whether it's systems biologists or more traditional biologists, you know, really tackling things like AIDS and malaria.
Mm.
And there's a great paper in Nature not that long ago from Microsoft Research and some of our collaborators from other universities, you know, looking at using machine learning techniques to be able to do a genomic analysis of the AIDS virus and its mutations and of humans and how the virus attacks particular kinds of people,
mm-hmm.
you know, based on their genetic structure and the genetic structure of the virus. Really interesting work.
Hmm.
Some, you know, fascinating work that's been going on in being able to apply the sort of mathematics of concurrent programming to systems biology and the way the and allowing you really to describe how the cell does some of the things that it does. Again, interesting, fascinating work. Don't really know where it's going. But, you know, historically, we were doing research in computer vision before there was any part of Microsoft that was doing anything related to computer vision. So we're not afraid to do research in areas that Microsoft isn't currently working in. In the future, you know, it may be important to us. We'll have to see.
Excellent. That's a beautiful thing, and that's a great thing for the researchers as well, because they can come and do what they love without necessarily having the pressure to build something that's going to be immediately used by the company. I mean, they can still do their basic science.
Right. Well, but I think that's really important. I think one of the mistakes that people often make when they think about building a research lab is they don't really want to build a research lab. They want to build something like an advanced development facility. And, you know, Microsoft as a company has great developers, and many of them are doing really advanced work. And so we don't need to have Microsoft Research doing that. The important thing for us is to be doing things that nobody else would be doing, to really move the state of the art forward, to take risk, because we're allowed to take risk. It's okay. I mean, in a product group, ideally you don't want to take very much risk. You always take some. Sometimes you take more than you'd like. But your goal is to ship something. Your goal is to make something happen. And you have a schedule and a plan. And if you don't get there at the end, you really have to feel bad about it. I mean, and your boss will make you feel bad about it. Maybe you'll get fired. Who knows? Within research, it's important to take risk. It's not necessarily that research ideas take a lot of time to develop. Sometimes people will ask me, are you working 5 years out or 10 years out? And that's not really the right way to think about it. It isn't a question of time. It's risk. It's when you start, do you know whether you're going to finish? Do you know if this idea makes any sense or not? And ideally, if you're taking enough risk, a certain fraction of what you do doesn't work, right? You're trying out ideas. And in some sense, it's much easier and cheaper and faster to do that in research than to imagine trying to do that in a product setting.
Absolutely.
So that's really the way, you know, I think of research. I think it's a place where you can take risk, you can try out new ideas. Some of them will work. Some of them will produce results that you can take advantage of. And then when that happens, we work really hard to harvest those technologies and get them into our products.
Excellent. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you.
Nice talking with you.
And this has been a nice event, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you again.
Yeah, maybe sometime when I'm not just immediately getting off an airplane.
It's amazing. Well, you did a great job.
All right. Nice talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.